10.
I don't know if anybody in the site history managed to have lecture number 10 by Tuesday of the second week, but we made it. So today, let's quickly revise our sequence. Given a Hamiltonian, we've been looking at how to get the ground state. And from the ground state, which is our target here, we would like to understand properties of ground states of local Hamiltonians. From the ground state, we've looked at reduced density matrices from which we could extract eigenvalues and then compute entanglement entropies as a means to characterize the structure of entanglement in this ground state. So today, we want to talk about free fermions. Okay, I want to go through the free fermion formalism, which is closely related to the free Majorana formalism. And so what I want us to think about is the case where we would have a Hamiltonian, which is quadratic in fermionic operators. So we'll have n fermionic modes. Our degrees of freedom are n fermionic modes with a quadratic Hamiltonian, and our goal is to understand how to get how to first express the Hamiltonian, which, as you remember, usually was a 2 to the n times 2 to the n matrix. We will express it in terms of just this matrix of coefficients. There will be n times n coefficients. Okay, so efficient representation of the Hamiltonian, from which we will be able to compute, express the properties of the ground state in terms of just an n times n correlation matrix. Okay, so again, efficiently, the reduced density matrix for a region A of size L would be an object 2 to the L times 2 to the L, but we will express it in terms of L, a matrix, a correlation matrix that grows linearly in the size of the region L. All right? And the eigenvalues of the density matrix will be extracted from just, so here we have 2 to the L. We'll just need to compute the L eigenvalues of this correlation matrix. Okay, and the idea is that you can, from here, you can expand these L values to obtain the 2 to the L values for the probability. Okay? And finally, we could either take the root and still compute the entanglement entropy, but the entanglement entropy is going to be a sum of L different contributions, each one corresponding to the entropy of a single mode. Is that the question?
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay.
So we were dealing with like a strongly coupled system, and we can basically map it to a free system and figure things out there and then map it back, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the continuum limit, that free system is going to turn into a CFT, and you have certain things that you know there on like what happens with criticality, like you know the scaling dimensions and stuff, and people can solve that.
Okay.
So what I was wondering is whether the mapping between them has some nice properties, like quasi-locality, which would...
The mapping between what and what?
Between the Ising model and the lattice version of the CFT. Like if that has certain nice properties, and for example, you know in a CFT what, like that correlation functions will, two-point correlation functions will decay algebraically. So that would translate to a property
okay.
in the
So the only map we have, the only map we've been using, which was in those notes that you had yesterday, it's called the Jordan-Wigner transformation. If we have time, we'll have a look at it today. And that map is a map between fermionic or Majorana degrees of freedom and spin degrees of freedom. It's not between spin degrees of freedom and a CFT, right? It's a map between two types of lattice degrees of freedom, which you could also extend to the continuum in some way, okay? But we're on the lattice,
okay.
and the idea is we have a map between different types of degrees of freedom, and this map is not local. But for given Hamiltonians, such as the Ising model, when you apply this non-local map, the Hamiltonian, which was local in the spin degrees of freedom, is mapped into a local Hamiltonian in Majorana degrees of freedom. Right? So the degrees of freedom individually, say sigma y, is not mapped into some, sigma y is a local operator in the spin degrees of freedom, is not mapped into a local operator in the fermionic degrees of freedom. But sigma y does not appear alone or does not appear in your Hamiltonian. What you have is sigma x times sigma x. So individually, sigma x on one side would translate into a non-local operator in fermionic variables. But sigma x on one side times sigma x on the next side, the product of those translate into a local operator also in fermionic or Majorana variables. We'll see that later today if we have time. Otherwise, it's included in the note that you had from yesterday. So it's important, this mapping. You have some notes on the wiki on the Jordan-Binger transformation. So for specific, the map is non-local. For specific types of Hamiltonians, a local Hamiltonian is mapped into a local Hamiltonian. Very good. So what do we want to do here? Well, one of the things that I understand was a bit difficult the other day with the Majorana formalism was how to relate the single particle energies to the multi-particle energies. So here we have n different single particle energies that come from deionalizing these metrics. We have 2 to the n, so we have 2 to the n energies, multi-particle energies, the eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian. And it turns out, and we also have this just n of those. But the idea is that all of these can be obtained by deciding signs on the sequence of sums and subtractions. Okay? So if you want to, given n numbers, if you want to get 2 to the n numbers, you just add those numbers plus or minus with a plus or minus sign, choice of plus or minus sign in front of each of them. Okay? And there is a very similar relation between, similar relation between how to take from L values here, how to produce 2 to the L values for the eigenvalues of the reduced density metrics. Good. And in case you wonder what type of physical system this is, I'm going to explain what these fermionic modes are. But the one key property here is that this Hamiltonian quadratic in the form A dagger A implies that there is conservation of particle number, right? There will be some, we can define a particle number operator. It's counting the occupation number in fermionic variables. And we will see that this Hamiltonian preserves it, or we can check it quickly. And so the type of, with respect to Majorana, a Hamiltonian which is quadratic in terms of Majorana operators, that only preserve parity or, you know, in the spin variables, spin flip, invariants under spin flip, where we had a Z2 symmetry. Here we have a U1 symmetry. Okay? It's a match, we go from just spin 1/2, sorry, from preserving the parity of the particle number to preserving the parity the particle number itself. Okay, so let's get started with this. So let's say this is 10.1. And we want to talk about n fermionic modes. And so we can start with the operator algebra. And this is something you've surely seen before. So we're going to have n fermionic annihilation operators. So I'm going to represent them as A sub I, where this index I is labeling the n different modes. And so, well, no surprise here, we'll have that they are defined to fulfill anti-commutation relations. And then if we try to represent them as matrices, if you try to produce n different matrices that fulfill these relations, it turns out that then the smallest non-trivial way to do that requires 2n times 2n matrices. Okay? So we would be this would be acting on a 2 to the n, to 2n dimensional Hilbert space. It's the same as the Hilbert space, dimension-wise, it's the same as having n spin 1/2 quantum spin. It is useful to consider canonical transformation. By canonical, we mean that it's a transformation into a new set of modes that still obey the same relations. So what we're saying here is if you allow me to define a vector with the n modes and annihilation operators, then what I'm saying is that we can define a new set of modes by b equal to u, a unitary transformation u. So u dagger equal to u dagger u equal to the identity on n times n. So u belongs to un. Then if you do that, if you define this new set of modes, then automatically they obey the same anti-commutation relations. Okay, and we are going to be using that. Okay. Any questions there? We'll use the space a little bit better. So 9.2. Now I want to deal with n modes, but first just a simplifying case, n independent modes. Okay, and by this what I mean is imagine we have a Hamiltonian, which is sum over n modes, and I'm just gonna call them b. Okay, I'm going to denote the annihilation operator by bk. And if I give you a Hamiltonian like this, what you can see is that there is a single sum over k. Okay, so this is the sum of n single mode Hamiltonians that do not talk to each other. And we could solve this directly, but just to bring this into the language of spins, which you might be more familiar or have better intuition with, and I insist that this is just for convenience, but we could stay there. I'm just going to translate it into spin operators to understand the structure of this Hamiltonian in a simple way. So this would be epsilon k, sigma z k, and then plus some constant. So if you are not too familiar with fermionic operators, here is a spin version of this. This is just a constant. Okay? So you can check that these operators fulfill the same type of relations as these sigma z. And then, as this linear combination of sigma z, and then we can ignore this. And what we have here is that we have n spin degrees of freedom, spin 1/2 degrees of freedom, each one with some energy attached to it. So you can imagine of n independent spins where each one has some magnetic field applied to it, given by the energy or related to the energy. And so what's the ground state? We can ask, what's the ground state? And so the ground state will be of the form the ground state of the first one times the ground state of the second spin all the way to the nth spin, where Si is Sk is going to be either 0 or 1 depending on the sign of epsilon k, right? Because what we are trying to do here is lower the energy. For each spin, we'll have to decide if the energy is positive, then we don't want to have a particle there. If the energy is negative, then we want the spin in state 0, or we want the spin in state 1. So S specifically here, Sk is going to be 0 if pk larger than 0, or 1 if pk smaller than 0. And now we have a fancy way of writing this. We'll say that sk is equal to, let me see if I get this right, 1 minus the sine of epsilon k divided by 2. Okay, let's check that this makes sense. I said the spin state 0 if the energy is positive, okay? So that we collect a minus epsilon k contribution, or 1 if the energy is negative, so we don't collect any contribution from this side. And this can be expressed in this way. So if the sine is positive, then this is this function, sine of x is what? It's going to give us plus 1 or minus 1, depending on the sine of x. Okay. So if this sine is positive, then 1 minus, we get a minus 1. So 1 minus 1, we get 0. If the sine is negative, 1 minus minus 1, we get 1 plus 1, 2 divided by 2, we get a 1. Okay. So we're going to use this trick or this way of expressing things. It's going to be convenient. And what's the ground state energy? So the ground state energy, you can, if you want, go back here and see, you know, we're going to occupy the state. We're going to have a particle depending on the sign, again, for each of the modes. So we could imagine if these are the energies, and we have 0 here, imagine that we have, let's see, as an example, we could have E1 is here, E2 is here, E3 is here, E4 is here, right? But what we're saying is that the ground state will want all the negative energies full, and all the positive energies empty. Okay? That's the structure. It's a product state where we make a decision whether we have a particle there or not, whether the spin is in state 0 or 1. And so the ground state energy is going to be, in this example, it would be, come here and we see, okay, energy 1 is positive, so we don't want to have a particle there, so 0 for energy 1. Energy 2 is negative, so we do want to have a particle, and then we get the energy is plus E2, but of course this is minus the absolute value of E2. Now we go to E3. We again get the contribution. And the particle 4, we don't want it there. But this would be the ground state energy. And then the rest of energies of the excited state, you just come and start playing around. You can put particles where there are no. You can remove particles where you have them. And you have to add the energies that come with that on top of the ground state energy. Okay, so let me write the ground state for you in this case. What we said is that the first mode is empty. So that's a 0. The second mode is full. The third mode is full. And the fourth mode is empty. That would be the ground state. Okay? Yes?
Sorry, I didn't get where the structure comes from. So why this particular order for E1, E2?
It was an example. So in general, you'll have energies. I didn't specify what they are.
Okay.
And you just need to look at their sign and make a decision.
Mm.
Right? So okay, so.
So we do not assume that they are sorted.
Example. Sorry, we've not said that, right? So I'm not assuming they are sorted.
Okay.
We could, then what would happen is if you start with the negative energies, those modes are going to all be filled, and the positive ones are going to be empty.
Okay, so it's just about when we get the eigenvalues, we sort them by size and
then
usually we start like E0 is usually on the lowest. It's just about sorting the
In this case, we didn't have to diagonalize anything. It was just a list of independent modes, and I don't assume that they come with an order. Okay? All right, so we have this ground state, and now what we want to do, if we want to talk about the correlation matrix for it. And so the correlation matrix, first I'm going to talk about this object, okay? And then I'll define what I mean by correlation matrix. But the idea here is that, maybe let's just do it explicitly with that example, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0. Now, if we put an annihilation operator here, right? And we annihilate, if we attack a 0, we get nothing, so that would be a 0. If we act on a 1, then we can get a 0. But you know, if we act on this guy, there is a 1 waiting here. So what we have is that this for sure comes with a delta k, k prime, right? Because whatever you change here by means of this annihilation operator, you better rectify it again, put it back on the second guy. Okay, so what we have is that we have n uncorrelated modes, and indeed the correlation this expectation value reflects that. We need k prime. So we need the creation operator to undo whatever the annihilation operator has done. Otherwise the overlap of the ground state with after acting with this operator with the ground state again will be zero. And then what we need to decide is what happens when whether we have a zero or a one. In this case, okay. So what I'm saying is, depending on whether, so let's start with the first mode, right? If we go with B1, so let's start with the first mode. Let's consider this element. If we apply B1, if we try to destroy the particle here, there's no particle, so this is going to be 0. If we do the same for B2, then we can destroy this particle, and then we'd better replace it back. Okay. So in this case, we're going to get 1. And so this is, again, this expression here, how we choose a 0 or 1. It's the same expression that we had before. And based on that, now I want to define a correlation matrix. So this is going to be my definition. Okay. And I'm going to put a tilde here to that will make sense later on when we deal with a more general case. I'm going to define it conveniently as delta k a prime minus 2 b k dagger b k prime. So what I'm doing is I'm just shifting this value and rescaling it a little bit, and so that I can write this as sine of e k. Okay. So it follows from what all I said that if you look at this expression here on the ground state of any independent mode, then it's just diagonal in k, k prime, and you choose either a plus or minus 1 depending on the sign of the energy. Very good. Is that kind of clear? I mean, there is no magic here, okay? Linear algebra. At most, complicated notation, but the notation is actually made in this. It's chosen so that the next step will be simpler to understand. So if there are no questions, I'll move to n correlated mode. OK, so now we can go to 10.3. I want to deal with n correlated modes. So in this case, the Hamiltonian will not be diagonal in the modes that we're dealing with, but instead will have n times n, so n squared coefficients. It's the more general quadratic Hamiltonian we can write if we place the dagger first and then. So we don't consider terms like this or like that. We explicitly exclude those terms, focus on terms that are of this form. This is the particle preserving character of this Hamiltonian. Okay? If we had terms like Ci, Cj, we would be destroying two particles. That would not preserve particle number. But if every term in the Hamiltonian creates and destroys and creates a particle, then we have particle preservation. OK, so we can write this. And then where Aij is a n times n matrix made of real of complex numbers in general. And then hermeticity of the Hamiltonian implies that Aij, or that A, this matrix, is self-adjoint. And if you want to know in which sense, well, I just explained this was particle number preserving, but what you can do to see it explicitly is to define some particle number operator. And then you can show that, so you can show that this particle number commutes with a Hamiltonian. It basically, so in the end, what this follows from the fact that, as you can check again, that this is true. And so the type of symmetries that we have, the type of symmetry is that you send each annihilation operator, you could send it to I phi AI. If you do this, then under this transformation, obviously AI dagger is sent to e to the minus I phi AI dagger, and then AI dagger AJ is sent to itself. Okay? So the Hamiltonian is invariant because you can change the phase, you can change each annihilation operator by the same phase, multiplied by the same phase, and the Hamiltonian is going to stay the same. Okay? Because the Hamiltonian is made of these terms here. And each term is invariant under this transformation. OK. So there is a theorem, which you all know, that says that if you have a matrix that is self-adjoint or Hermitian, that's an n times n matrix, then there exists some unitary transformation in Un. U equal to U, U dagger equal to identity on n times n, such that A can be expressed as U, D, U dagger, where D is diagonal, and I'm going to call the eigenvalues En. Oh, did I call them epsilon before? No, E, okay. Okay, so where these eigenvalues are real. Okay. So what we can do with that is we can define new modes B by U dagger A, and then the Hamiltonian is automatically of the form that we just discussed. Okay? So we apply a canonical transformation of the modes. We remember, if we define these modes in this way, automatically the annihilation operator B fulfill the anti-commutation relations, and the Hamiltonian then reads like that. Question?
Are we doing a special case of what we did yesterday?
It is a special case in which you have particle preservation, particle number preservation.
Should this come down to the same thing?
Yes. So what's, but it's much more convenient to do it. So when you have particle number conservation, instead of dealing with 2n times 2n matrices, you can deal with n times n matrices. All right, so then remember that what we have here, the correlation matrix for the B modes, which was defined as dk, k prime minus 2, expectation value of dk on the this expectation value on the ground state, we argued it was delta sine of epsilon k. So what that means is that actually this is just this matrix, this correlation matrix, is nothing but what I'm going to call the sine of D, right? So what's the sine of D? Given a diagonal matrix D, okay, the sine of that matrix will be just a matrix where I replace its entry with its sine. Okay, so this is just going to be a diagonal matrix where I don't know which sign I'm going to have on each entry, but I know it's plus or minus 1. Okay, so then if we want to talk about the correlation matrix, so we can define correlation matrix M in terms of the original modes. Okay, this would be in terms of the A's, not in terms of the B's. But then this is going to be nothing but a change of basis from So this, you know, if we change basis here, if we go from the A's to the B's, then we could do that, and by undoing, so we would express this in terms of the M tilde, okay? But what we can do is we can come to the M tilde and change back to the A modes, and then we'll get, after the change of basis, we'll get that we can express the new correlation length, the new correlation matrix for the A's in terms of the correlation matrix for the B's times the change of basis. Okay? And so what that means in the end is that M is nothing but U. Then what did we say this was? This was the sine of the diagonal matrix U dagger. Okay? So this is the correlation matrix for the ground state. Has a very simple expression, where this U, I remind you, this U is the one that diagonalizes the coefficients of the Hamiltonian. So if this was our Hamiltonian, if this was were the coefficients, the n times n matrix of coefficients for the Hamiltonian, then we can diagonalize it. And if you want to know the correlation matrix for the ground state, just go back to this expression and replace D with sine of D. Okay? So there was some steps of derivation. Everything was complicated because of notation, but it was just linear algebra and simple replacements. And what's nice is the final expression, that if you want to know the correlation metric for the ground state, you just have to take the metrics of coefficients for the Hamiltonian, you diagonalize it, you keep the u, you take the sine of d, and u sine of d u dagger, that's your correlation metric. Very good. So what do we do once we have the correlation metric? We're ready to compute the correlation metrics for a reduced density metrics, and from there extract maybe the entropies or entanglement spectrum. So we're going to do that next. What we have then is this m, which is an n times n matrix. What we're going to imagine is that we have all modes, all our modes, there are n. And now we're going to define some region A, and this region will contain L modes. And so what we would like, let me write this. This is some metrics. Let's suppose this is A. This is the rest. So what we have is that our correlation matrix refers to modes in A and modes outside A. Right? So we have both in row and columns, we can identify the entries that correspond to region A, and the correlation matrix for part A is going to be L times L. I'm going to call it MA, and that's just going to be precisely this submatrix. Okay? That's, as Nick would say, isn't that what we saw for the other case, for Majorana modes. So yeah, it's the same. Very good. Now, by construction, maybe you can see it here. M is a Hermitian matrix because it's diagonal made of plus or minus one, so real numbers, and then u u dagger. That automatically means M is Hermitian by construction. So if you take a submatrix, diagonal part, a block, diagonal block of a Hermitian matrix, you still get the Hermitian metric. And so we have a theorem that says that we can diagonalize this metric. Okay, so what we have is MA dagger is equal to MA, and therefore there is some V, which now is a unitary on L times L, unitary, such that MA can be written as V, some diagonal matrix. I'm going to call the eigenvalues mu1, mu2, all the way to mu n. Okay. And then, in particular, we can define so what that means for us is that there is also, there exists a set of modes C, L modes, which we obtain by a linear combination of AL. This is restricted to L. Okay, there are only L modes in all of these vectors. I'm calling the A's, right? These are the annihilation operators we started from, but I'm restricting them to the L annihilation operators that act on region A. Right? So we had A1, A2, AL, AL plus 1, AN. And I'm saying now this vector here refers only to the L first. And I'm saying we can also take a linear combination in terms of a unitary transformation to define new annihilation operators, C. And then because of this property, we know that the expectation value of this form for the C's is delta mn cm dagger cm. And this is nothing but 1 minus mu m divided by 2. Okay? Remember that this correlation matrix was defined in terms of, well, somewhere here. There is a delta minus 2, this expectation value. So if I want to take this expectation value, I just need to bring that to the other side, this to this side, divide by 2. And so that justifies the relation between this expectation value, this expectation value and the diagonal entries. Okay? But basically what we're saying is that in the modes that diagonalize this correlation matrix, in those modes, right, there are no correlations when we work on those modes, there are no correlations between different two of those modes. So what that means in practice is, if you want, we can directly call this thing here M A tilde, right, which is diagonal, and then in this tilde variables, the reduced density matrix would be that of, again, L and correlated spins. So the reduced density matrix on those variables would look like the density matrix of, it's the product of individual density matrices for uncorrelated spins. And if you want then to understand the spectrum, the 2 to the L eigenvalues of this correlation matrix, this density matrix, so that's a density matrix. If you want to understand its 2 to the L eigenvalues, you just have to look at, you know, these are already the eigenvalues of each of these density matrices. We have L of those. And so all we need to do is the P alphas are going to be just the result of taking 1 plus mu 1 divided by 2 or 1 minus mu 1 divided by 2 and then multiplying it by 1 plus mu 2 divided by 2 or 1 minus mu 2 divided by 2. Okay? Although we make a choice all the way to the last, to the L value. So what I'm saying is that each of these values here will come from multiplying. You make a choice of top or bottom for each L modes or spins, and then you multiply the resulting choice, right? So for instance, an example would be this times this times this times this times this, okay? And now you do that. There are 2 to the L different ways in which you can choose what elements to multiply, and that gives you the full spectrum of the density metric. So in principle, we have all we need to produce the 2 to the L eigenvalues. Okay? And now we could compute the entropy of attached to this 2 to the L eigenvalue of the density metric for region A. But that would be actually not a good idea. We would have to build this 2 to the L. 2 to the L for large L is not something we can deal with. If we just wanted to compute the entropy, then we still have that this density matrix is the product of density matrices. And so we can exploit the fact that the Entangment entropy is additive. What this means is that this entropy is going to be the sum. So the entropy of a tensor product of individual density matrices is equal to the sum. This is additivity of the entropy is going to be the sum from k equal to 1 to L of the entropies of individual density matrices. And we know how much each one is, how much the entropy of one is, right? It's the entropy of this pair of eigenvalues. And so that's going to be sum from k 1 to L, put a minus here, and then we have 1 plus mu k divided by 2 log 2, 1 plus mu k divided by 2 minus plus 1 minus mu k 2 log 2, 1 minus mu k divided by 2. Okay? So we could compute the entanglement entropy for the region without actually having to build exponentially many eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix, instead of having to diagonalize this guy or extract the 2 to the L eigenvalues of this guy. We can compute the entropy directly by computing the entropy for each of these L density matrices and adding the entropies together. Good, so this completes what I wanted to tell you about how to study entanglement in the ground state of a free fermion Hamiltonian. And now we could discuss the Jordan-Binet transformation, but first, are there questions? Good. So I've told you before that we had this 2 to the n times 2 to the n representation of this n annihilation operators. Yeah. Yes?
There's one equation that I don't fully understand. Like, so you say you can write the vector c as v dash n.
Yes.
And then to the right of that, you calculate that correlator. Why is it even delta? It's like, your ground state is going to be like 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0 for the independent modes. But C are not independent modes. It's the A's which are independent modes.
OK. So for the ground state, we have to go back somewhere here. And what we had was that the correlation matrix was diagonal for the B's. These are the B's, right? For the A's, the correlation metric looks like whatever happens after you take this diagonal metric and you conjugate by a unitary. So in general, it's not going to be diagonal. Now, when we take, so M is not diagonal, right? And this is for the A's. These are the A's.
Wait, A's? Didn't we start off with C's?
That should have been A's. That's a typo.
Yeah, they're A's.
Okay. That's a typo. This should have been A's from the beginning. Right? It was A's everywhere. So, yeah, I apologize. There was a typo there. So we've been working with A's today. And then what we said is that if we want to diagonalize the Hamiltonian, we would have to go to some B's, right? In which case the correlation matrix for the B's was diagonal, but it's not when you go back to the A's. So in particular, when we go and look at the reduced density matrix or the correlation matrix for the corresponding to the reduced density matrix for region A, what we find is that this is not going to be diagonal. But then we define the C's as those that make this correlation matrix for part A diagonal. Okay? So
yeah.
we construct C such that the correlation matrix is going to be diagonal. Okay?
Okay.
Good. So let me mention this Jordan-Winger transformation. What I said before is that we have this set of n annihilation modes, A1, A2, AN, that fulfill these anti-commutation relations. And usually, if you want to talk to your computer, you cannot say, hey, represent anti-commuting matrices. What we can store are numbers, right? Matrices as we know them. And if we are acting on different sites, this would be the tensor product of identity on all the sites times non-trivial metrics on one side and so on. You remember how you build the Hamiltonian for the spin model. But we can still build 2 to the n times 2 to the n realizations of these operators. So the idea is AM is not going to be identity on most of the places and non-trivial on one side, but instead will look like this. It's going to be sigma z so remember we have n different a's and or modes, and if this was m, then we're going to have a string of sigma z's, and then here we're going to put sigma m x plus I sigma y divided by 2. Okay. And you can show that if you do this, so here's where you put sigma x plus I sigma y divided by 2. So if you define the a m in this way, you can show that this AM indeed fulfill the right anti-commutation relations. Okay. There is no other solution to go and try. Okay. And I don't want to try this. I mean, you can do it. It's not too complicated, because every time you attempt to have a pair of these guys, the product of 2 will come with a string of z's, but another string of z's, the first position m, second position n, and most of the sigma z's will cancel, because you take the product of sigma z with itself. The square of sigma z is the identity. And so when you do this product, you will get identity in. Well, only non-identity between m and n. The rest is identity. Anyway, it is useful. This afternoon we'll play with specific free fermion Hamiltonian. And this free fermion Hamiltonian will have terms like this one, am dagger am plus 1. And am, so the am plus 1 dagger am. Just the join of this. And what you can do is now you can replace AM and AM plus 1 with this expression. And what you can see, for instance, is that this is nothing but a sigma x m, sigma x m plus 1, plus sigma y m, sigma y m plus 1, which is known. This would be a spin Hamiltonian. Or spin the so actually, if we take this, if we take a sum over m here, okay, so this thing is a Hamiltonian known as the XX quantum spin Hamiltonian, spin chain. Okay. So again, what we find is that, as I mentioned before, this transformation is non-local, right? Here you have an object that supposedly only lives on site M or mode M. But when you try to express it in terms of spin variables, you have a string of sigma z. Okay? So instead of in spin variables, this is not an operator acting on just one spin, but it's an operator acting on many spins, right? But it turns out that when you put together a product of these two terms, right? and it's, well, we make it Hermitian. Then individually for each M, what we have is that this is mapped, this product is mapped into a term which is local in spin variables as well. Okay? So this is a spin Hamiltonian, known as the XX model, that, again, we would in general solve with complexity exponential in N. But because of this map, you can solve it with complexity n cubed. And actually, this is what you're going to do this afternoon. We'll look at how to solve this model as a second example of pre-particle Hamiltonian that we can solve. And by solving this model, you will be learning about the physics of pre-fermion, but also about the physics of an interacting spin model. Okay? Very good. Are there questions? If not, we are done, and I'll see you this afternoon.